Good afternoon, and welcome to We the People Radio. My name is Aaron Ryan.
And I'm Bill Cundiff.
And you can find us at wethepeopleradio.us. And our sponsor this hour is...
Team Power. Team Power. They're the Kubota tractor dealer in Shasta Lake City in Redding area. They service Shasta, Siskiyou, Tehama, Lassen County. Well, not part of Lassen County. But yeah, all your Kubota needs, go up and see them. They do part sales and service up there. They're at 3119 Twin View Boulevard in Shasta Lake City. Or you can give them a call at 226-9226 or get them on the web at RedingTractors.com.
Ta-da!
Yeah.
Look at that.
They're the guys.
Hardly any...
Nary a hiccup.
Foolishness, but I've got this stool that's like, I feel like I'm on a perch.
You are. Chirp, chirp.
If I flap my wings and take off, you'll know what happened. It was the perch. Oh, my goodness. Well, actually, by the end of this, we're probably going to be ready to flap our wings and fly off because our topic today is something I guarantee you that I wish we could actually know this, that people who are listening, I wish they could kind of like push a little button and give us like yes or no or thumbs up, thumbs down, whatever. But I'll be nice, and I'll say 95% of the people out there don't know this information, and we all should. The article that our guest has sent is entitled "The Problem with the Current High Potency THC Marijuana from the Perspective of an Addiction Psychiatrist." So we're not talking to somebody who's just a
hater.
There you go. just another hater. That would be us. That's the role we fill in. All we're qualified to do is that.
Yeah.
But she deals with people who are addicted all the time, and that's the one major difference. Most people will tell you that.
And not just marijuana. All
marijuana
addiction.
Is not addictive. Yeah. But we're focusing kind of on that, and I'm sure we'll veer into the other lanes. But our guest today is Dr. Libby Stout. She is a board-certified addiction psychiatrist, worked in the addiction behavioral health field since 1990. So she's kind of been there and done that. She's been the medical director for the CIRCLE program, a 90-day inpatient treatment program funded by the state of Colorado for persons with co-occurring mental illness and substance abuse who failed other levels of treatment. She's been doing that since 1999. And strong advocate of the need to address all addictions at the same time, including tobacco, in order to improve outcomes. I listened to a presentation she did up in Mount Shasta here, like 2nd of February. By the way, the date today, if you're listening, if this happens to go through a replay at some point, we're actually airing this live on February 24th, 2019. Happy birthday to my dad. It's always really nice when something happens where you have to say the date because then you remember whose birthday you were about to maybe skip or forget, which is always bad. And I have a video on there courtesy of Robert Exter, who did the editing on that and has made those available. So the YouTube video, you can view it on our website at wethepeopleradio.us. You click on the show for the 24th of February, 2019. You will see the video there. You can go to YouTube, watch it there, forward the show however you like. We'll have an archive up by 2:15 or so. And then later this afternoon, we'll put the commercial-free archive up, and that will stay there until the website no longer exists. Yeah. And you are free to take those MP3 files, send them to people, copy them. I don't care if you put them on CDs and sell them. We do this program to educate people. So however you want to get the word out is totally good with us.
If you do sell them, I'd like a cut.
Which cut? You want the first hour or the second hour?
Probably first hour.
Oh, you're talking money.
Yeah.
failed that one. So anyway, we'll probably play some silly music just to lessen the pressure. But lest you become confused, we are not fans of marijuana, medical, recreational, or otherwise. And this program will be all about the how not great it is. And this will not be one of those fair and balanced programs because, frankly, I think the how great marijuana is 90% of the conversation out there, which is how we wound up with it legalized in our states. Boo. And the pipe dream of the magical pipeline of money that's going to come. And then if we legalize it, then all the criminals will go away. And
schools will have more money. Everybody will have more money.
I should have played Somewhere Over the Rainbow. I didn't put that in my list for today, but just be humming that in the background. So let's get our guest on here. I know she's on there, Dr. Libby.
It's mostly, hey there, thank you.
Yeah, it's mostly all you now.
Hey, thanks for coming on today. I'm looking forward to this.
I tried to give Bill a synopsis of your talk, and it was like, yeah, it's kind of complicated. We're going to have her on the show.
Well, I'm happy to be here, and you know, I do want to start out by saying I am not a hater.
Oh, we are. Okay. That's all right. We'll be the haters.
When this first happened in Colorado back in 2000, I didn't vote for it. I just thought it was stupid, but I also wasn't that worried about it back then because I had been dealing with people with marijuana addictions for a long time, and I thought at the time it wasn't going to be any different than alcohol, and we would just be treating it the same way. But my perceptions have changed dramatically, and it's mainly because of what has happened with the THC potency. And without any regulation, really, the growers have been able to make product that has huge concentrations of the THC, the psychoactive component of the drug. And this has created considerable havoc, in my opinion, and those are kind of things I want to address.
Yeah, I'm kind of amazed that in light of legalization that they haven't put some kind of limitations or at least labeling as far as the potency on marijuana, because it is dramatically different than the old days.
And for people who haven't read the article, by the way, it is posted on the page for today, so we're not going to refer to something you can't ever find. It is on there if you'd like to read the thing. We're not going to read it to you, however, because that would be NPR, I think, mostly. Prior to the 1990s, this is from your article, it says, prior to the 1990s, the THC content was less than 2%. In the 1990s, it grew to 4%, and between 1995 and 2015, there has been a 212% increase in the marijuana flower. So that's the part you smoke and stuff.
That's medical grade now.
But then once you get into the concentrations of the oil and the shatter and the dab and all these edibles and stuff, concentration can be upward of 95%. So in case people think we're talking about some little, you know, micro change, I don't think 2% to 95% is a micro change.
No.
No, you're absolutely right. That's a really good point. And I just think it's really important that we pay attention to history. I mean, people are supposed to learn from history, but
it's the rumor.
I've gone back and looked at the history of cannabis throughout the centuries, and you know, it has been around for centuries, and it has been used medicinally for centuries, but it has been used with that really low potency, what I would call God's product, the natural product that's less than 2%. And if you think about it, any plant is not identical. One plant is different from another plant, and they're all going to vary in their concentration and things. And the cannabinoids differ in terms of the growth cycles, where they are in the growth and between the plants. And so I think what happened, because, you know, it started in China. There were people back in 6000 BC supposedly eating cannabis seeds for food. And then in some time, 4000 BC, they started using it for textiles, that like the hemp plant. And then in the first recorded medicinal use was in 2700 BC. And then it kind of got moved from China and got transported across India and to the Middle East. And I think it's just kind of fascinating that even though it was very, very available, in 1378, the emir of the Ottoman Empire actually made an edict against eating hashish or smoking cannabis.
Oh, really?
And then in 1798, Napoleon had this total prohibition on his soldiers smoking marijuana. And what I've read about that is it's because he recognized that all of the lower class people were utilizing marijuana, and I think that's why he could invade so easily, because they didn't care. And actually, in 1868, Egypt became the first modern country to outlaw cannabis.
Huh.
I just think that's fascinating, and I think it's possible because there were more potent plants in different places, and people were having different reactions, and you know, some people are more susceptible to the effects of THC. But, you know, back then nobody knew anything about that.
Sure.
Right.
Well, and that's one of those things that we're headed into our first break here, but we want to make sure that we go into the effects that we see, because let's face it, the bulk of the public, especially the people who are making the rules, the folks that are, say, 50 and over that are on city councils, and I realize there are younger people, but those folks are significantly out of touch if they're not pot smokers or whatever. They don't know any of this has happened, and they're comparing it to the 2% product of the 1960s and 70s, thinking, well, it's not that big a deal. You know, nobody gets nobody gets addicted. You hear that all the time. So I'm really excited that you're going to finally explain to people as a doctor what you see, and the fact that there is a withdrawal element, and then obviously what this will do to our youth as they start using it and how that's happening. So anyway, we've got a long list of stuff. So we will be right back with Dr. Libby Stout. You are listening to We the People. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us.
Rocky Mountain High, Colorado, Rocky Mountain High. I've seen it rain fire in the sky. Friends around a campfire, and everybody's high.
And since Dr. Libby Stout is from Colorado, I figured I should just get that one out of the way right away, and then we could be done with it.
Yeah, I love that song.
It used to be a nice song. Now it's kind of annoying, but I was like, all right, I'll put it on the list. We'll do it. Well, we'll do it early.
In the olden days, marijuana used to be classed as a hallucinogen. And hallucinogens are not considered addictive because they don't have a withdrawal syndrome. However, with the higher potency THC, we are now seeing a definite withdrawal syndrome, and we now see it as definitely an addictive drug. And the higher the potency, the more addictive it is. And so that, I mean, this is what all companies do to try and increase their market share. They increase the potency of a drug.
Sure.
If you think about any addictive drug, the higher potency ones are the most addicting ones. So hard liquor is more addicting than beer, 3-2 beer. The marijuana, just the higher the THC content, the more addicting it is.
Well, and if it's not on a hallucinogen anymore, what is it now?
Well, it's kind of in the class by itself, because it does have hallucinogenic properties. That's why people use it.
Right.
It does cause psychotic symptoms. But it also has a significant withdrawal, and so it is addicting.
Well, another thing that I find interesting with marijuana is, you know, they got a foothold in with the medical marijuana. You know, it had all these magical properties. But with any other drug, there's different potencies, like you were saying. You know, when you look at a prescription bottle, it says, you know, so many milligrams of this or so many milligrams of that. I mean, they've got it dialed in to whatever the symptom is. You can treat it with different levels of certain drugs. But with marijuana, it's all the same.
Just throw it at
just
it.
Just throw it. You know, you just go buy marijuana for your medical problem, and the potency, it was never an issue and never a factor in treatment. How'd they get away with that?
Well, again, it's these regulators that don't know anything about it, because I would agree. if you look at the research that has been done on marijuana in terms of what is helpful, all of the research has been done on potencies less than 10%. There isn't anything out there that's a legitimate, well-done study showing that marijuana, THC higher than 10%, is good for anything medical. However, if you go into any dispensary, and it's difficult to tell the difference between what's medical and what's recreational. And the other problem is the part of the plant which is considered to have the most benefit is the cannabidiol, or the CBD. And there's research out there that indicates that perhaps CBD is protective from the bad effects of THC. But right now, it's really hard to find marijuana that is in a one-to-one ratio where you have an equal amount of THC and CBD. Most of the stuff in dispensaries is really the high-potency stuff, where in Colorado, we're looking at plants with, you know, averaging between 17 and 30%. I even heard some people were bragging about how they're getting it up to 40% in the plant.
Wow.
Jeez.
Well, and I think it's interesting, too, that you can go into a dispensary and get marijuana for a medical use, and you're getting medical advice from a pothead behind the counter that's all of a sudden now an expert in illnesses, and he's going to prescribe you a drug to fix what ails you. I mean, how do they get away with that? I mean, that's practicing medicine.
That's an excellent point, and it's good very job, frustrating for those of us who practice medicine, especially in psychiatry, because they've got all these strains that they say are good for depression, good for anxiety, good for bipolar disorder, and people go and then they use those strains. And especially my concern is about somebody with true bipolar disorder who may be on a psychotropic medication for that. I don't hear the bud tenders asking them, well, what medication are you on? Let me tell you if this interacts with your medication. Because it's well known that these products interact with prescription medication negatively. And so nobody's doing that. And then, you know, the study they did in Colorado that was blew me away was calling dispensaries. You know, they had a woman who would call a dispensary and have this script that she would read saying, you know, I'm so many weeks pregnant and I'm having a lot of nausea, and do you have anything you can recommend? And almost 70% of the dispensaries recommended marijuana for the woman. And you can look at the article, they even have quotes, and one bud tender was quoted as saying something like, well, I don't think that you're really supposed to be using it, but if I was going to recommend, I would recommend something in high-potency THC.
Oh, wow. I mean, they don't even want you smoking cigarettes or drinking alcohol when you're pregnant, but pot's okay.
Smoke pot. Yeah. Yeah, it's no big deal.
But there's well-known effects of marijuana on the developing brain that are negative.
Yeah.
That's a big part of the problem, and this is what people don't quite understand. Is I think most people don't understand what happens during development, but there's two times when your brain is most active in terms of developing the neurological connections. You know, many animals are born with their brain completely intact. But humans are not. Humans, the brain is continuing to develop over time, and different things come online at different times. And the last thing to really come online is the prefrontal motor cortex, or the seat of judgment, or where you make all your decisions in your brain. And that doesn't really come fully online until late adolescence, early adulthood. And they keep pushing the number out further, but you know, what I heard was 21 in women, 25 in men. And so the brain is continually developing, but the most active times of development are in utero and then during adolescence or during puberty. And the cannabinoid receptors play a very big role in what is happening during development. Now, I just want to point out, I think it's very interesting that we never really knew what the active component of marijuana was until the 1960s. We knew about all the other drugs. We knew why they worked in the brain and why they were addicting. But it wasn't until the 1960s that a lab in Israel discovered THC. And they found that there was a receptor in the brain that THC fit into. And that's why they named it a cannabinoid receptor. I think people regret that they ever did that, because it wasn't until the 1990s that the same lab actually discovered why we have those receptors. And they discovered that we make this drug in our brain, our own drug, and they called it anandamide. That's a Sanskrit word for supreme joy. So it's part of our system that helps us balance and feel, you know, basically good, stable, normal. And so we have these anandamides that work in these receptors. And the anandamides are created locally. They're created immediately for when they're needed, and then they're dissolved. So they're used locally, and then they're gotten rid of. THC is a fat-soluble substance that binds to the receptor and stays on it for a very, very long time. And that can really affect development, because during adolescence, the brain is making a decision using these receptors of what are we keeping and what are we getting rid of. Because during adolescence, there's a lot of go, go, go neurons. Like we want to learn, we want to do, we want to record information. So there's a lot of the stimulatory neurons like dopamine and norepinephrine. And there's not too many of the brake neurons, which are serotonergic neurons, because those are mostly in your prefrontal motor cortex.
And those are the ones that make you stop doing stupid stuff?
Right, exactly. Okay. And so the anandamides are helping the brain decide during that period, are we going to keep this neuron? Are we going to myelinate this neuron to make it stronger and more active, or are we going to prune this neuron? And if you put an exogenous source of THC into the brain at that time, you have absolutely no idea what you are doing to that process. And I think that's why there's so much research out there now showing lower IQs with people who start using marijuana during adolescence, and, you know, cognitive problems.
Right. Hence the word dude.
Exactly. And the clothing choices. That's always a big giveaway.
Yeah, that's great.
Sad. I mean, there's just so much of this that we see, and I don't know, I guess ultimately if you don't laugh a little
well,
bit,
I think we all knew that, you know, growing up,
this wasn't
you're
an
constantly,
enhancement.
Well, you're constantly developing your brain, and when you drink alcohol or do any kind of a drug, you're going to do something to the brain, good or bad. It's obviously going to have an impact on that development. So it's interesting.
And now we've legalized something that actually makes it function less well, which, you know, I mean, for anybody who's driven a car lately on a public roadway, I'm thinking functioning better would be.
Yeah. Would be nice, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Be super. So we'll take a really quick break. We'll be back with our guest, easy for me to say, Dr. Libby Stout. We are chatting about THC and marijuana and how it affects your brain. You can find all that information at wethepeopleradio.us.
So she tucks her kids in at night, kisses her husband, turns off the light, talks to God. Says the Lord, help me accept what I can't change. But until I learn to do that, thanks for the Mary Jane. 'Cause you know life will let you down, love's gonna leave you lonely. Sometimes the only way to get by is to get high. Kids are different today, I hear every mother say.
mother needs something today to calm her down. And though she's not really ill, there's a little yellow pill. She goes running for the shelter of her mother's little helper, and it helps her on her way, gets her through her busy day.
The modern version of Mother's Little Helper.
I took it out of the middle of the song, but I thought, well, that's my Fair and Balanced, by the way. That's the Fair and Balanced portion of the show. So back in the, we had the two moms, right? So we got the mom now who's, you know, smoking pot, and the mom then, she's probably smoking pot too, but anyway. She was eating Valiums or something?
Yeah,
was
Valium.
I don't know what was yellow.
Little yellow pill.
It was no mom then.
So one of the things that I hear people say is when they smoke, they're more focused and more attentive. It helps them study. What do you say?
After reading
that?
Your article, it's like, this couldn't possibly be true.
Yeah, what's the illusion there?
Well, I think that's an interesting observation. Many people do say that, but it seems to be somewhat delusional because most of the studies that have been done looking at cognition show that it makes cognition worse in the long run. Now, it's kind of like nicotine. Most people, when they use nicotine for the very first time, they can focus better because it does help with focus and concentration. But then the problem is they become addicted to it, and nobody actually uses, well, some people do. There are the occasional smokers, occasional people, but most people, when they get started using tobacco, they become addicted to it. And then it makes them worse because then they're in withdrawal, and withdrawal is you can't focus, can't concentrate. And so we see the same thing with marijuana, that if somebody was just using it occasionally, small doses, it might be beneficial in that regard. But most people are not doing it that way. And that becomes the problem, because part of the marijuana withdrawal is also irritability, anxiety, can't focus. And so then you have to smoke again. And then you're in this vicious cycle.
Yeah.
And that doesn't really help anybody. But they've done studies looking at college students, and there was actually an interesting one in somewhere around. I don't think colleges were Yale, but it was done around the Yale area, and they looked at students through a semester of, you know, whether they were using alcohol, marijuana, or alcohol and marijuana, or marijuana alone, and they didn't have enough people just using marijuana alone to study that, but they found that the people that had the lowest GPA at the end of the semester were the people using alcohol and marijuana. And you know, those are people that probably have pretty good brain cells. You know, many of the studies on IQ says there's like an average loss of 8 points in your IQ. And if somebody is Mensa, or, you know, they have a really high IQ, that may not be a big deal. People may say, oh, I'm doing just fine. But if you're at the average IQ, which is 100, so that's 50% of the population are average, and you drop your IQ by 8 points, you're down to 29th percentile.
Yeah, you're on the short bus.
So that really can affect people's ability to function in life. And they're less likely to go to college, get married, do things.
And, well, hold a productive job, and now that
exactly
you need to have some skills, and you know, I mean, people who hire other people would like them to have some skills, be able to pay attention and do things. And somebody with a 92 IQ isn't probably going to be your stellar performer,
right?
And the world's gotten very technical.
And the concern is, for me, the biggest concern is you can't prevent the youth from using. And
sure,
especially if their parents are using, and their parents have the attitude that there's nothing wrong with it. And we have, in this society right now, the there's a big perception that marijuana is safe, it's green, it's organic, it doesn't have any problems, and it's good to use because it has all these medical things and it cures all these things, which none of that is true, but that's the message that everybody's getting. And so we're seeing more and more adolescents using.
And yeah, I saw in your article here that 65% increase in Colorado since in high school age kids since they legalized it, because that I guess that just sent the message is, hey, it's okay, it's legal, it's there's nothing wrong with it.
Right, but then there is also this really new study that just came out this past year, 2018, out of Denver, where they're looking at adolescent emergency room and urgent care visits. And they just looked at the marijuana-related diagnostic codes and the positive urine drug screens, and then looked at the difference between 2005, when, you know, we had medical, we didn't have recreational, up to 2015, which is a year into recreational. And they found that the visits of these adolescents jumped from 161 in 2005 to 777 in 2015.
Wow.
Wow. And what's very scary is that 67% of them required a behavioral health evaluation. So
wow.
They weren't there just for medical problems. They were there for mental health problems.
Yeah.
And 71% ended up with a diagnosis related to marijuana and mental illness.
Yeah. So.
And so this is one of the things that we're seeing. Because a lot of people have this perception, well, I smoke marijuana because it helps with my anxiety or it helps with my depression. And most of the studies are showing the opposite, that it actually makes person depressed and makes people anxious. And so in this study out of Colorado, that was what the number one diagnoses they were seeing were depression, mood disorders, and anxiety disorders.
When they first start use, is it different than let's say a year into using, you know, maybe when they first start using it, they do get some medical benefits, but then that quickly
goes
away.
Down the drain.
Yeah, is that the case at all?
Well, I don't know. That's a good question, because it's kind of like the chicken or the egg. There was a big study in Australia, this is back in 2002, where they tracked 1,600 girls for 7 years, and that's a huge study.
Yeah.
And they were following them, they picked them up before they had any issues with depression or anxiety, and they followed them for 7 years, and then they looked at the people that used marijuana versus the people that didn't. And they found that the people who used marijuana every day were 5 times more likely to suffer from depression and anxiety than the non-users. And if they used it at least once a week, they were twice as likely to develop depression.
That's still a lot.
And then, And then, of course, they, you know, the same study looked at the incidence of psychotic symptoms, so the risk of developing a diagnosis of schizophrenia, and they found a significant increase in that if they started using before the age of 15. And so, to me, that supports the idea that, no, they didn't have the problems, and marijuana made the problems.
Mm.
But nobody knows exactly. It's just that we know eventually, after some use, people are having worse problems with these things. And,
yeah.
You know, we've seen a significant increase in the rate of serious mental illness among young adults, and that's the people that are 18 to 25. And if you look at any of the data right now, nationwide, the people using the most marijuana are the ones 18 to 25.
Yeah,
so,
that's
again,
bad.
Kind of an easy correlation to, you know, make.
Yeah. Well, everybody wants to say, well, correlation doesn't mean causation. But when you keep seeing the same correlation over and over and over again, you start thinking maybe there is definitely causation.
Well, and you point out an excellent thing in your article, just right there on the second page, that because there was initially no regulation on the edibles, so that's the candy and all that stuff, They have been made to look very similar to regular products that people consume, such as chocolates, gummy bears, Pop-Tarts. Pop-Tarts, what the heck? And so then you have all this accidental exposure and overdose of kids. I mean, they even named one kind Girl Scout cookies. I was reading in your thing.
Yeah, who's that?
It's like, who are we marketing that to?
Well, right, and there was recently a big deal, and there was a big published thing of picture of Girl Scouts selling Girl Scout cookies in front of a dispensary. And, I mean, a lot of people I know challenged the Girl Scout Council about that. Like, you think this is a good thing? Because it does send this message to the girls, I think, that, you know, this is okay.
Yeah.
And...
Well, your point, you can't, you really can't take it too seriously, the idea. I mean, you really have to think about it. We have demonized cigarettes. We've had all these DARE programs in school. I was never able to remember what the stupid drug, the DARE thing. We laughed about it years ago when we first moved to an area that had that, and we laughed and called it Drugs Are Really Exciting. It's not the right name, and I've never been able to relearn that. But it's about drugs are really bad, but that doesn't spell DARE. So kids are really paranoid in a lot of cases. You know, ooh, cigarettes, oh, they're really bad, you know. And
yes.
Now
yes.
Here we're making, you know, suckers and Pop-Tarts and all these things. And if their parents have those laying around, especially little kids, little kids put everything in their mouth.
Looks yes, like, absolutely.
Looks like candy. You put it in there twice.
Yeah, we've seen significant increases in children coming to the emergency room because exactly that.
Well, and those are the things that are like 90% THC.
Yeah, scary. Very scary.
When we come back, I want to know what the long-term kids who get involved in that stuff, peripherally, parents aren't paying attention. They've got all these edibles hanging around and they don't notice their kid has been staring at the same spot on the ceiling for... you know, half a day. What happens when little kids get exposed to that for long term? We'll be right back with our guest, Dr. Libby Stout. You are listening to We the People. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us.
Whether we like it or not, the best I can tell, the world's gone to hell and we're all gonna miss it a lot. All the whiskey in Lynchburg, Tennessee just couldn't hit the spot. Got $100 bill, you can keep your pills, friend, it's all going to pot. I got $100 bill, you can keep your pills, friend, cause it's all going to pot.
Because I got high.
Go to the next.
I was gonna go to work, but then I got high. I just got a new promotion, but I got high. Now I'm selling dope, and I know why, because I got high, because I got high, because I got high. La da 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 da. I was gonna go to court before I got high. Ooh, I was gonna pay my child support.
And the song starts out lower than that, and it goes downhill from there. But that's the way it goes. And I guess part of playing these songs, not only are they kind of funny, but they're kind of funny. And a lot of them, you know, we've heard for a lot of years. I mean, Merle Haggard and Willie Nelson, I mean, I heard these people have been around for a long time. So we've normalized it there as well. And of course, we're
right.
Contributing to the problem. But what happens with kids when they're exposed to this stuff as little kids?
Well,
turn out like the guy in the song.
the problem is it actually primes the brain. One of the things that we know about the development of addiction is exposure during childhood adolescence can increase the risk of addiction. It doesn't make the person become an addict, but it can prime the brain so that when the person actually decides to use for the first time, they can be hooked the minute they use. And a lot of this research has been done with tobacco, but it really applies to any smoked drug, because when you're sitting in a room full of smoke or a car or something where somebody else is smoking, the secondhand smoke gets into your brain. I mean, it clearly does.
Right.
This is actually how we got smoking out of airlines, because they found that when people were non-smokers in the front of the plane, after they got off the plane and they had to pee in a cup, they had enough nicotine in their urine as if they smoked three cigarettes. So it gets into your body, which also gets into your brain. And so kids that have this exposure early on, their brain becomes primed to that. And I see so many people in the treatment program that I run, who especially about tobacco, they go, I can't stand the fact that I smoke. I was never going to smoke. I hated the fact that my parents smoked. I said, well, what happened? And said, I don't know. When I was 13, I took a cigarette, and I was addicted that minute. And I think that's part of the process, is that you get exposed to it, but then it's, you know, usually peer pressure during adolescence that causes kids to use things. And if they've been exposed to it already, then they're likely to be addicted from the minute they use it.
The first contact with it, they are hooked.
Because they already had that wiring all done.
Right, exactly.
And I don't think people really understand that.
Yeah.
I really don't. Is this... I'm not going to say this is publicly available, because obviously you're not a secret psychiatrist. all confidentiality aside... But, I mean, do people, I don't know, I guess I've never really heard that. I've never studied it. But that's not really being widely shared, I don't think.
No, and I would agree with that. And that's why I try and do a lot of education. I mean, I can point people to all kinds of research done with animals. I mean, there's many studies done with rats and mice where they expose them as adolescents to nicotine, for example, and then they're more likely to use nicotine as adults than if, you know, they press the lever for it. But there's also cross-tolerance in the brain. So the brain doesn't really see these as different. The brain just says, oh, these are all drugs of abuse, because they all work in the exact same place in the brain. And so there are studies showing that you expose an adolescent rat to nicotine, they're more likely to press the lever for cocaine. Or you expose them to Ritalin as an adolescent, and they're more likely to press the lever for cocaine. There's even a psychiatrist who has tried to use the same theory to explain why anesthesiologists are the branch of medicine that have the most addiction problems. And it's not because people go into that with the plan of becoming addicted. But what he's discovered is that the problem can be is that fentanyl, which is the primary drug used to put people to sleep in the operating room, is injected into the body, and then it goes through the body, and then the person breathes it out. So the person sitting closest to the head the entire time they're in the room is the one most exposed. Now, that doesn't make them an addict, but I can absolutely see this happening, where the person says, you know, I wonder what the big deal with this drug is. So they have a little spill of fentanyl, and they put a little drop on their finger and put it under their mask on their gum. And they could be addicted from that minute just because they've been exposed to it. And now they are getting used to it. And then they start using it. And this is a serious problem in different areas of... Because I know actually from my own experience, I have several classmates that were found dead in call rooms because of using fentanyl.
Wow.
And so I think that the exposure data is very powerful, and I think people need to think about that. And this is why whenever I'm teaching anybody, like my patients, I get them to swear that they will stop smoking around children. Don't smoke in a car, don't smoke in a house, you know, don't smoke anything. You know, marijuana, nicotine, crack, heroin, because the smoke gets it into other people's bodies.
Right.
Wow, that's really something you don't think about. It seems like,
right.
You know, the effect would basically be over. So, and I know in the video that we have attached on the page from the talk you did earlier in the month, you were speaking about your practice helping people get off drugs, and you had said something that I think everyone in the room knows, that when people go to AA, they smoke tons of cigarettes. I mean, if you've ever been, you know, your church basement or, you know, some room in a building that you also use is also the AA room. It's like 9,000 ashtrays in there. It's pretty common.
Right.
And a lot of people in AA smoke. I mean, again, I kind of wish we had that button. We could say, okay, how many of you out there, you know? But you had said that if they don't give up everything, the wiring never gets changed.
Well, this is because of the effect of these drugs, and this is all addictive drugs,
right,
on the hippocampus. So the hippocampus is the part of our brain where we put all of our new memory and learning. So it's where you put the important stuff you want to remember. And the hippocampus is a part of your brain that actually regenerates. So there are new cells being born all the time in that part of your brain as stem cells that grow and differentiate. But the problem with all addictive drugs, and this includes THC, nicotine, just chronically can actually suppress neurogenesis and actually shrink the hippocampus. So they have imaging data showing that hippocampuses are smaller. And that makes it difficult to learn new things. And so this is why if somebody is in treatment for drug abuse and they're smoking the whole time they're in treatment, they're having difficulty learning anything new.
Right.
And this
right.
is why I advocate that all treatment programs, if it's residential or inpatient, should be totally tobacco-free, because you can control that. You know, they control everything else. You can't use any other drugs when you're there. And so they should be tobacco-free. Outpatient, difficult to control. But now, one of the things that they've discovered from imaging is that it takes 90 days for a stem cell to grow and differentiate in your hippocampus. Now, that makes complete sense, because if you think about AA, if you've ever been there before, they have a common saying that says 90 and 90. That means if you want to quit drinking, you have to not drink today and go to a meeting to ensure you don't drink today. And if you do that 90 days, you're going to start getting it. Well, and my point when I mentioned this was, I said, but this is why most people don't recover in AA right away, because AA is a cup of coffee in one hand and a cigarette in the other hand.
And a lot of cookies.
So you're basically still suppressing
neurogenesis. I've really been there, but.
Right.
And so if you really want to get better, like learn something new, because I truly believe recovery is completely possible. And I see many people recover really completely.
And see, that's a really important message for people to hear. I hate to do this to you, but we have a 5-minute news break that is creeping on us.
Yeah, I want to get back to this.
So we have a whole nother hour with Dr. Libby Stout. You are listening to We the People. You can find all the information we're discussing at wethepeopleradio.us.
I want to feel its way. I want to feel its way. Put some feel good in my soul. Drag a little drink, smoke a little smoke.